He was dressed all in black and had a black top hat on his head. This appearance alone is extremely strange, but Carmen was particularly struck by his very pale, almost wan face. The man looked at Carmen very intensely and did not seem to be interested in her friend at all. He also had very strange eyes. Carmen described them as X-ray eyes and felt a hypnotic look in them. She felt very uneasy and asked her friend to walk a little faster because she was afraid of this man. After a few steps, she looked back at him and noticed that he was still staring at her. This experience seems to have bothered her a lot, as she still brings it up today. So there really do seem to be different ways of looking at these black men. We will certainly learn more about these mysterious figures in the future. But how can you behave in the case of such an encounter? How can you tell whether the person is acting for or against you? In this case, too, we should rely on our inner voice, on our first impulse. A look into the eyes of such a person, if there is one, can certainly provide even more clarity. But Carmen has also had other experiences, as has the rest of the family, but she is currently trying to suppress them. For example, she remembers that when she was between 5 and 6 years old, she was visited several times at night by a man who stood next to her bed and stroked her head. But she was not afraid. Later, she said, she had seen a glowing ball floating in the room. The ball floated back and forth until it suddenly disappeared, which Chandra, who was with Calm, also noticed. Another extremely interesting story is the story of Yu, Chandra's friend, who was also the one who saw the Aldebaran woman at the garden gate. The best thing about it is that Yu, who claims not to believe in such things at all, has now become quite shaken in his worldview. Chandra, who was lying next to Yu, woke up one night to a strange loud banging noise. She looked around and saw Yu lying at least a meter from the bed. If he had just fallen out of bed, he would not normally be lying so far away from it. Also, falling out of bed would not have caused the banging noise that Chandra had heard. In her opinion, it must have come down from above. Chandra immediately stood up and asked Yu, horrified, what had happened, whereupon he groaned. Too much electricity. They gave me too much electricity. Then he got up and wanted to leave the bedroom, but instead of going to the bedroom door he ran in the opposite direction, towards the wall. Chandra spoke to him about it and said that the door was in the other direction, whereupon he changed direction and went to the door. When he got there he wanted to turn on the light. But when he touched the light switch the cable burned out. There was a loud hissing sound and the power went out. Having regained some sense of consciousness, Yu said that he had found himself in an unfamiliar room and was sitting in an armchair, where he had been connected to some wires. He remembered a kind of measuring display that had been at a low level, for example the value 10, and then someone had turned the power up, to about 30. He felt pretty bad after this event and could hardly walk anymore, his back was so sore. So they went to the nearby hospital the next morning to find out what was causing the pain. There, blood was taken and an egg was performed, which revealed such high leukocyte counts that it was assumed they indicated severe inflammation. Interestingly, astronauts who have been in space have also shown such high leukocyte counts upon their return. An X-ray of his head and neck was taken to determine where his pain was coming from. They were then sent home with instructions to come back the next day to check his condition. The next day, the pain had subsided somewhat, but Yu decided to see an orthopedic doctor. When the doctor wanted to see the X-rays, he went back to the hospital to pick them up, but to his surprise he was told that they had disappeared. That was extremely strange. Even the orthopedic doctor was taken aback and said that something like that shouldn't happen in a hospital. He had never seen X-rays disappear before. Either they had really been messed up or there was something on them that they didn't want to reveal to the public. But the down-to-earth Yu was confronted with strange circumstances once again. He had a dream. But this dream, as we have now established, was more than just a dream. Yu dreamed that he was lying in bed and sleeping, but suddenly woke up because Sandra started screaming. When he went to the window in his dream, He saw Sandra being taken away by two large beings with long blonde hair. A third being, also with blonde but very short hair, ran after them. They were all dressed in turquoise overalls and ran with Sandra into the nearby forest. In his dream, he was so panicked that he drove off in his car to look for Sandra, but to no avail. This dream bothered him so much that he called home from work several times the following day to make sure that Sandra was really at home and that everything was okay. This dream still bothers him today, but this is also related to the fact that on the morning after this dream, two screws were missing from the door handle, which had apparently come loose for some inexplicable reason and disappeared without a trace. These were just a few examples to show that these events are certainly more than just exaggerated fantasies. You in particular is a person who has both feet on the ground and has never believed in these phenomena. To this day, he has not read a single book about UFOs. But shaken up by these experiences, he has no choice but to come to terms with the fact that we are all visited by extraterrestrials. It also shows us that not only our family, but also our environment is involved in the contacts, which once again confirms the law of resonance, according to which people who think, feel or act in the same way attract each other. Marcus, the youngest, whom Sandra saw with the Aldebaran on board the spaceship during her hypnosis, was not spared from the contacts either. He himself also has memories of various experiences, even without hypnosis, but he is reluctant to talk about them. In one case, he was about 5 years old when he and Karen saw a UFO. This UFO was circular and glowed red-orange and, after standing motionless in the sky for a few minutes, shot off towards the south, Austria, at an unimaginable speed. Fascinated by this event, Marcus became curious to find out what this UFO was all about. It was about a year later when he told his mother about the following experience. "I suddenly woke up in the middle of the night and had the feeling that something was coming into the room. The room suddenly became bright and I was overcome by a terrible fear. I knew that something or someone was coming to me and I pulled the covers over my head to protect myself from this unknown person. Then I felt something touching me, feeling me. I could no longer move and was completely helpless against this something. But the fear went away. Then I can't remember anything. I probably fell asleep." At the age of about 7, he also had a strange dream that seemed to indicate a similar experience. "In the middle of the night I saw small beings coming into my room, over the balcony. These little ones were accompanied by a large being with long, blonde hair combed back. It must have been quite early in the morning because I remember looking at the clock shortly afterwards. It was just before 6 a.m. and therefore time to go to school. In this so-called dream, I thought that I didn't want to go to school because they were there. But they told me that I had to go to school. I don't know how much time passed, but suddenly I woke up and the clock still showed just before 6 a.m. so no time had passed at all. Apparently they had played a trick on me." Marcus told Karen about this dream at the time, but by then both had long since forgotten these little episodes. They only came back to mind now when Jen asked our family over and over again about experiences in our past. Marcus had several more dreams like this. He often dreamed of spaceships in the sky, and one time the whole sky was covered with them. Another time he even said that he had seen a disc that had a dome on top and a window on the bottom. And Karen was the two, he said. Chapter 27. The Power of the Mass Media, by Raina. This chapter is not really directly related to the title of the book, but I would like to take the opportunity to tell you about the experiences I had during my television appearances in 1995 and 1996. I am keen to open your eyes a little to how we, the masses, are manipulated and deliberately made stupid. Through my many appearances on television and interviews for various magazines, I have been able to gather some involuntary knowledge and have gained some insight into what really goes on behind the scenes. They are only a few, rather insignificant experiences, but they show us clearly where things really go. You should know that nothing that is broadcast via the mass media can be taken at face value. You should always be aware that it is only about profit and ratings, never about real enlightenment and true information. The talk shows in particular are pure show and ultimately only serve to dumb people down. They are mostly based on lies and have the sole purpose of declaring trivial things said by some people to be incredibly important and distracting the viewer from what is actually happening on Earth. In addition, many people who appear on such shows have even made up their stories in order to have been on television once in their life. It is sad but true, but I have experienced it myself, and not just once. Sometimes everything that was said in front of the camera is presented in a different light and important details are cut out. Different contexts are passed on, depending on what the editors want to achieve with their report from the viewer, and in the end, much is true. Hardly anyone can know that most critics on such shows are only paid to make someone look ridiculous or bad on camera, and their personal opinion is often the opposite, but the money is what attracts them. Let me give you a few examples. After a show in which I described my contacts with the Little Greys, a critic, he does not want to be named, came up to me and apologized with sweaty hands and said that I should not take it personally, he had to talk like that. I wonder on whose behalf. I had the following experience during another television appearance. The editor-in-chief, with whom I had a long conversation before the show, advised me not to make any political statements during the show, as it would be far too hot and controversial. Of course, I knew that I had to be very careful with my statements, it was still too early for that. In this conversation, I had actually only wanted to make it clear to the editor-in-chief how broad the UFO topic is and that one inevitably has to enter political territory in order to better understand the interests behind UFO secrecy. Although I had only spoken about my personal experiences in the program, a fortnight later I received a call from the publisher who had originally wanted to publish our reports and was asked not to say anything more about the Aldebarans in public. The lines were already running hot, even the public prosecutor's office had already contacted me and threatened to withdraw the license if Jan Van Helsing was involved in any way. I was also not allowed to mention anything about German flying saucers or my relationship with Jan Van Helsing in my lectures and appearances. So we had no choice but to take a different approach, because we are not easily intimidated. Crazy, isn't it? Why is there so much fuss just because we have found certain parallels? Parallels that go back to the First World War? Even though this book was not due to be published until autumn 1997, half a year later, there was already this trouble beforehand. This shows how quickly certain circles can put a stop sign in your face. If these statements were just so-called nonsense, why this approach? Why these threats? And evidently certain circles are extremely afraid of Jan Van Helsing's revelations. Because wherever Jan appears, there is a lot of excitement. So he must have stirred up a hornet's nest, otherwise no state organs would react in this way. If all his statements were just figments of his imagination, why do his books have to be confiscated nationwide, arrest warrants and tax investigations applied for, and permanent house searches carried out? You can buy drugs on every street corner in Germany, not to mention child pornography and weapons. Everyone sees it, everyone knows it, and everyone keeps quiet about it. Evidently, this is part of a real democracy. As the saying goes, a democratic state must be able to cope with that. But Jan Van Helsing's books have obviously exceeded this limit, the limit of what the nation of Germany can tolerate. A really interesting aspect, don't you think? But his opponents have betrayed themselves through their behavior, revealed their names and shown everyone how much freedom of opinion the Germans actually have today. At another television appearance in March 1997 in Berlin, a critic was invited who tried rather clumsily and emotionally to ridicule us UFO contactees or to discredit us in some other way. He was of the opinion that our statements about the sightings and contacts were pure figments of our imagination and that so-called alien abductions were just products of our imagination. After the broadcast, I confronted him and asked him directly whether he really stood by what he had said during the broadcast. With an uncertain smile on his face, he answered me, Yes, of course, in Raina's opinion, this was meant ironically. But you know, the show has to go on. Also not uninteresting is the story of when JH's film team came to my house in February 1997, interviewing the whole family all day long and filming our house from every nook and cranny. At some point I found the time to exchange a few personal sentences with the editor-in-chief. I asked her who was ultimately responsible for what was actually broadcast in the end and who decided what was censored and what was not. She avoided my question, but then confirmed my suspicion that they were not interested in the people and their stories. And it was irrelevant whether the story was true or not, ultimately they were only interested in the ratings. They had been told from the upper floor that they should put together a report on this or that topic, always about what was being talked about at the time, whether it was UFOs or small-scale warfare in the allotment garden. Great. Interestingly, when the program was broadcast, I discovered that everything I had to say about the government's knowledge of extraterrestrials and the positive things I had to say about the Aldebarans had been cut out. I wonder why? Another example. When I took part in a television recording in March 1997, I met a couple from Dortmund. We were taken to the airport together on the Sunday after the recording, and we then had the opportunity to have a long conversation in the airport cafe. This couple had taken part in another recording, which was also filmed on the same day. When I asked the couple how the show came about, the woman said that they had contacted the station when the topic of a household dispute came up. She calmly explained that she and her husband had agreed in advance what they would tell the viewers. They both confirmed to me that the story they told on television was not true. They also thought that it would be nice to spend a weekend in Berlin at the station's expense. They had often appeared on other talk shows on a wide variety of topics. When I asked them how they did this, they replied that they regularly watch the current talk shows and then choose a topic that they would like to appear on. They would then contact the station and negotiate the price. When I heard this story, I was struck by the impudence of these people and, of course, horrified that you can't believe anything anymore. Chapter 28, On the Reality of the Afterlife. Some people will certainly have already thought about how the afterlife might be connected to life on other planets. If we remember what Dr. Schumann said about this world and the afterlife, then a conscious transition to the afterlife should actually be possible. But how is it all connected? The question is whether this requires a prior death in this world or the transformation of the body in this world through material transformation. This would also make the alchemical idea of achieving immortality through transformation understandable. But what is this world and what is the afterlife? Comment: when this book was written quite a few years ago, research on this topic was not yet well known, but after YouTube and hundreds or thousands of websites on this topic have become available, there should not be much doubt in the spiritual researcher about this topic. We have now even received confirmation from university science that death does not actually exist. We are made of energy and energy cannot die. It can only assume other states. Just as an ice cube does not die when heated, it turns into water. It only changes its state of aggregation. It is the same with us living beings. We have a physical body with a very specific vibration pattern and a specific frequency. The soul, on the other hand, has a higher frequency, a higher vibration rate, in which time passes completely differently. If we want to stick with the example of water, we could compare the physical body with the ice cube, the soul with the water and the spirit with the water vapor. Everything consists of the same substance, only the vibration rate at which the molecules vibrate, the frequency, distinguishes them from one another. But the afterlife is not in heaven or somewhere else, far away. It is here and now, right in our midst. We just cannot perceive it with our five senses. With these we can only recognize very specific frequencies, only a very specific range of Hertz values. Everything above that does not exist for us. For example, the dog whistle. The dog can hear it, but we cannot. Nevertheless, the sounds are there. And yet there are a few people who can also hear these sounds because they are able to perceive higher frequencies. Again, we know from parapsychology that animals, especially cats and dogs, react to the dead, they bark or become restless. And so there are also many people who can do this, so-called clairvoyants or aura readers. They are able to perceive these higher vibrations, that is vibrations that the ear or eye of an average person can no longer perceive. However, all people can sense these intuitively, via the solar plexus, popularly via the stomach. Everyone knows the feeling of coming into a room or a building and having an uneasy feeling in your stomach, feeling unwell. You can perceive these energies, but only if some people can see them correctly. This would in turn confirm that the so-called afterlife is simply a higher vibrational octave on which life takes place at a higher frequency. The question of whether it is possible for us humans to change the state of matter from this world to the afterlife without physical death could therefore be answered with a yes. The idea of Christ consciousness, that is the union with the higher self, the immortal part of us that does not incarnate in the physical body, is based on the principle that a person, through selfless, pure and always loving actions, manages to transform his own vibration so high that it manages to reach the higher frequency of the afterlife during his lifetime, and thus the change from one state of matter to the other does not have to take place through physical death. If you live harmoniously, that is, if your feelings and thoughts and the resulting actions are used harmoniously, the chakras, the energy centers of a living being, through which we absorb cosmic energy, come into harmony, as do the movements of the molecules and other energy particles that we are made of. And this continues until we have accelerated the speed to the point where it has reached the frequency of the afterlife. Examples of this were Jesus, Ramtha, Hermes Trismegistus, the Count of Saint Germain and many others. They were supposedly able to consciously reach this high frequency of the afterlife, or simply put, the next higher frequency level, during their lifetime and to travel between these worlds without any aids, such as time machines or UFOs, that is only through their consciousness mastery process. A side effect of this was that they no longer aged after reaching this frequency, Christ consciousness. Now it seems that a large part of the extraterrestrials, whether Pleiadians, Sirians or Aldebarans, completed this process a long time ago and already exist on a higher frequency level than we do. Probably not all of them, but many. And it seems to be possible for them, with and sometimes without their flying machines, to transform themselves down into our physical world. Thus Mr. X found the following thoughts about the afterlife in secret Templar writings, which he put into modern words. All matter in the afterlife is infinitely more elastic than in the cosmos of this world and thus indestructible by its standards. Likewise, all life in the afterlife, whether intelligent or not, is immortal and physically indestructible by this world's standards, whereby the body of a being in the afterlife far surpasses the material of the afterlife in terms of strength. In the afterlife there is no cosmic physical speed limit due to the expansion of the universe and the speed of light, which means that the afterlife can be compared to a hypothetical Tachin universe. Just as in the cosmos of this world, there is also time in the afterlife, so the afterlife is not timeless. This afterlife time passes extremely slowly for our afterlife concepts, but can also be infinitely accelerated or condensed if necessary. The afterlife is not uniform, but divided into various afterlife universes, all of which are embedded in a kind of afterlife Tachin universe, which itself is divided into different zones. All of the afterlife matter and all of the afterlife beings are formable and changeable, but not destructive, which means that the afterlife beings cannot be killed. Now the members of the Vril Society were obviously convinced that if they were not able to achieve Christ consciousness, being Christ in the self, in that life, it must be possible to bring about the transition from the vibrational level of this world to the afterlife, at least using technical means, that is flying saucers. So about flying saucers with a self-generated higher frequency field that enabled them to penetrate into the so-called afterlife and travel there, to bridge great distances in the universe without any notable loss of time, the afterlife flying machines. And if we can believe what we have published in this book, they were actually successful. What we still refer to today as death is actually nothing more than a transition from our third dimension to the next higher one. Our physical body, the shell, is then no longer needed. It is not important there. Much more important and necessary are the thoughts, the knowledge, the insights and experiences and our awareness of them that we take with us into this other world. Therefore, it also seems that various extraterrestrials, whose existence already takes place on a different vibrational level, are connected to the. These are connected to the so-called dead, as they have the ability to visit other dimensions and reside in them. Chapter 29, A Short Summary. Let us now take a look at the picture that appears to be formed by the information received from Rayner, but also from the Vril Society. Around 735,000 years ago, Aldebaran spaceships came to Earth in search of other habitable planets, but probably even earlier. They found other living beings, natives of the planet, possibly also colonies of other extraterrestrials who had already settled there, and then founded their own colonies. Over the course of the eons, there was also mixing of the different races, as well as interventions in the genetic makeup of the native inhabitants of Earth by various extraterrestrials. It seems that not everything went so well here. If one assumes that the story of the Sumerian tablets translated and interpreted by Zechariah Sitchin in his book series The Twelfth Planet refers to this era, it even seems that a type of human worker was bred. The Pleiadians also report this. According to these tablets, these slaves, also called Chandalas, who were bred as hybrids and were sterile, discovered how they could reproduce and later rebelled against their masters. The slaves then became independent and, despite their artificially degenerated genetic material, began to reproduce and mix with other races. Through the mixing, new human races emerged with genes from aliens, slaves and the former natives, which continued to mix and ultimately gave rise to the many different races and cultures of our planet today. Some seem to have mixed more, others less or not at all. The Aldebarans, like most other extraterrestrial colonial rulers, set off again in search of new planets, leaving their own colonies and the newly created beings behind. In this sense, we Earthlings are the real extraterrestrials, since we once came to this planet, that is from outside. Now these various types of extraterrestrials came back after a long time to look after their so-called children, to study their development and to see what they had caused with their interventions. They were probably horrified to discover that it was not particularly good to interfere and play God. We find regret about their actions not only among the Aldebarans, but also among the Pleiadians and the Sirians. It must also have been a very difficult undertaking for colonies of different races to live crammed together in such a small area. According to various extraterrestrial messages, a planetary system normally seems to be populated by a single race. Furthermore, they will have realized that the gene mix was clearly not a very good one either. By intervening in the genetic substance to make the creatures of that time into hybrid workers, some of the gene strands were changed. They certainly did not want intelligent slaves, which would lead to the conclusion that without this intervention we would have been capable of more, namely faster ethical and spiritual development. This may be one of the reasons why we humans do not have 100% access to our brain volume and cannot work with both halves of our brain at the same time. The extraterrestrials now saw the result. War, hatred, materialism. Instead of working for one another, we worked against one another. Instead of people recognizing their common origin in spirit, they measure themselves by the external characteristics of race, religion, language and territory of the respective colony, country, and fight against any other attitude. The conditions of that time have worsened, nothing has gotten better. People have even gone so far as to destroy themselves and the entire planet out of pure selfishness and stupidity. So the Aldebarans decided to intervene in the history of the Earth again, to fix what had been messed up and this time to make a positive intervention that would enrich everyone, with the consent of those involved. But where? It was obvious to first look at their indirect descendants, who had remained most similar to them in terms of culture and nature, the people of Thule, Atlantis, and the Germans.